open our eyes and our hearts.
I would thank you for the opportunity to talk to you this morning and about a mission that I'm extremely passionate about. Habitat for Humanity was formed back in the States, back in the mid-70s, and since then, through the generosity of millions of people worldwide, has been able to rehouse some in excess of 500,000 families. You think about that, it's probably 3 million people that have been affected by that. So to set the scene this morning, I have a little YouTube clip about Cambodia that I'd like to show you.
Khuan Suvir Damphong was founded in Cambodia in 1995. At that time, the country was coming out of a 25-year war, in particular out of the terrible Khmer Rouge period, which had made Cambodia one of the poorest countries in the world and had destroyed everything. Cambodian society, its social structure, and traditional values. Children had been indoctrinated in special camps where they were taught how to kill, to denounce even their parents, and to torture. These children have now become parents themselves. Many of them are extremely violent, and their children are the victims. The association was created when we discovered the Phnom Penh garbage dump in November 1995. There, in stifling heat, among flies and rats, hundreds of barefoot children rummaged through a decomposing, stinking, worm-infested mass of refuse in which they sank up to their knees. We were stunned by what we saw. Tiny children, filthy, thin, with festering wounds and exhausted gazes. And still worse, the children were eating in this stench. It was horrible to see. We stood there stunned. We never imagined a place like this could exist. It made us want to cry. We felt sick, overcome with such a deep enraged feeling that it was impossible for us to allow these children to continue living in such conditions. From that moment on, our lives were going to change. As we started to talk with the children, we'd heard about even more incredible suffering, incredible mistreatments in this garbage dump. Some children were dying from the illnesses, others as a result of violence, still more run over by bulldozers that spread out the rubbish. We had to act quickly. With our savings, we started distributing meals to the starving children on site at the dump. But there were too many of them, and it was terrible to watch the suffering of those we could not help. We soon realized that helping all these children was beyond the ability of just the two of us. At the end of 1995, we left for France to mobilize our families and friends, who all understood the urgency of our task, and mobilize. At the beginning of 1996, we came back with sufficient funds to start a small program. Pour un sourire d'enfant was born. It was a race against the clock to save these children. First, we had to feed them and to provide medical treatment. So we built a straw hut close to the garbage dump to provide a meal every morning and administer first aid. After that, we had to get them away from working on the rubbish dump as soon as possible and provide them with education. Because their mothers were so poor, we had to compensate the families for the loss of their children's earnings. The limited public education at that time didn't suit children who had never been to school before and were considerably behind other children their age. It was necessary to set up remedial schooling. So we looked for a piece of land close to the dump site where we'd be able to build very simple buildings. We recruited our first Cambodian teacher. It was the beginning of our remedial center where the children studied the equivalent of 2 grade levels in one school year. Within this same year, we welcomed our first 10 children, then 40, 60, 120. By 1997, 250 children were coming to the center. We were not guided by the idea of growth, but by our commitment to address all of the most urgent cases, to leave no child in danger, to consider each child as our own. The race continued. There were so many children in distress. Step by step, PSC's action extended to other children in danger. Small street vendors, beggars, maltreated and abandoned children. We had to build classrooms, toilets, and infirmaries. Besides providing schooling, we set up support programs according to need. Daycare centers so that mothers could work, kindergarten classes, psychological support for children suffering from trauma, programs for children with physical or mental handicaps, a feeding center for undernourished babies, housing to protect the most maltreated children, and so on. Yearly 3-month tours in France and in other European countries designed to raise funds and awareness on our children's situation became a tradition. A growing support network was created by mobilization of local support groups. But we realized that schooling and our other existing services were not enough, that some children, even after passing the lower secondary school exam, still couldn't find a job and wound up back at the garbage dump. After surveying the labor market, we set up vocational training, which wasn't available in Cambodia at that time. Secretarial skills, hotel school, construction, mechanics, hairdressing, gardening, nanny and housemaid training, business school. We wanted the best training for the poorest students to make sure that they could find a job after they finished their schooling. For each training school, we got support from key European organizations to ensure quality. For example, we worked with the Lausanne School for our hotel school, Norrato for our mechanic school, and the Essek Group for our business school. Today, more than 6,000 children are supported in different programs, of which 1,500 are studying in the vocational training schools. All of them appreciate the value of this schooling and are enthusiastic learners. Nearly 100% of our graduates get a good job with Cambodian companies who appreciate the quality of our training. 3,000 young people have already been successfully integrated into society. Altogether, we have succeeded in building a wonderful machine to combat misery, whose value is acknowledged by the Cambodian authorities and by France, which awarded the association the Human Rights Prize, even by the United Nations organization, whose World Food Program director quoted it as a world example. But it is far from finished. There is still so much to be done, so many new challenges, and so many children waiting for us. Help us so that the maximum number of children will benefit from this beautiful machine.
To read Matthew 25, 34 to 46. Then the king will say to those on his right, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me." Then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you?" The king will reply, "Truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me." Then he will say to those on his left, "Depart from me, you who are cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not invite me in. I needed clothes, and you did not clothe me. I was sick and in prison, and you did not look after me." They also will say, "Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or needing clothes or sick or in prison and we didn't help you?" He will reply, "Truly I tell you, whatever you did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do for me." Then they will go away to eternal punishment, but the righteous to eternal life.
Well, good morning. I've been very fortunate to have had the privilege to be in Cambodia for a month with Habitat for Humanity as part of the Mekong Big Build 2013. My role was to be there for 3 weeks prior to the arrival of the 148 international volunteers that were coming from 13 different countries from all around the world to assist in ensuring that the site was ready for the volunteers to perform meaningful work. It's not my intention this morning to spend much time on a travelogue of my time in Cambodia, although I could probably talk for hours on that. Rather, I'd like to focus on some of the individuals that I came in contact with, their circumstances, and hopefully be able to challenge you with some of the issues that they face each day. Let me tell you about Net Nye, one of the home partners In fact, the home partner that the Kiwi team built for. Net Nye is 53. She lives in a shack that measures about 5 metres by 6 metres, with her 5 sons, a daughter-in-law and her granddaughter, in a place called Preet Toil Village. This is squatting illegally on land that backs onto the Stingmichi dump site in Phnom Penh. She's a widow, and she shares responsibility for sourcing the household income with two of her children, Soan, who's 33, and Chiang at 18. Nye and Soan work as rubbish collectors. They get up early in the morning and travel the streets, scavenging for anything that they can find to recycle. And the other son, Chiang, works in a hotel. Preet Toil Village is built on lowland that floods regularly, and that's exacerbated by the lack of sewage and drainage system. Houses are densely packed together, and rubbish is strewn all around. The landowner prevents residents from accessing the state water supply, so Nye has to buy her water. And the family often suffers with headaches, colds, and other physical health problems, spending precious income on buying medicines and visiting the hospital. Their house is built with scrap and that they found on the rubbish tip. It has a second hand, well probably third or fourth hand, corrugated iron roof that's full of holes, so it leaks badly when it rains. And the walls are made of rotten wood and corrugated iron, and they have one window that's made from a piece of plastic film. We had the opportunity one afternoon to visit the Preet Toil Village, and so after convincing Nye to come with us to show us where how she lived, we set off in a bus for the site. This was Nye's first ever ride in a bus. Can you imagine that? She sat in the front seat and did her best, unsuccessfully I might add, not to smile. I was sitting just across from her and I just wished I could have got a camera around on a stick in front of her. It was just an amazing sight to see the little grin on the side of her face. You know, this was the beginning for her of a whole new way of life. As we got off the bus, she grasped my hand and set off for what was about a 1.5 kilometre walk through her neighbourhood. All the time she was looking back to make sure everybody was following on behind. We had a guide with us who was adamant that we'd go a particular way, and Nye argued with him that she knew a better way, but the guide won. What he didn't understand was that the main route was flooded due to the heavy rain the night before. Nye walked through there with a determined step, head held high, as if she was saying to all the neighbours she walked past that these are my friends and I'm not going to be with you here much longer. The further we walked, the worse the buildings became and the deeper the flooding, till it was right over the top of our boots. Also, the blacker and smellier the water became, with obvious signs of raw sewage. I thought I'd seen poverty and terrible living conditions before, but nothing I had ever seen had prepared me for what we would witness. The stench was just indescribable. Many of the people with me had dust masks in their pockets, and they put them on as it was hard to breathe without inhaling the terrible stench and feeling it in the back of your throat. I found that pretty hard to take, and thinking that these people have to live with this all the time. Surely we can put up with it just for a few minutes. What we saw was whole streets of houses made with rubbish from the dump. Nye's house, while the floor was above the outside water level, didn't really make a lot of difference because the place was sopping wet from the rain the night before. There was a raised platform about 2 metres by 4 metres where the whole family slept. Underneath it were a few pigs that they raised. There was nothing else visible in the house. Nothing. No cooking facilities, no bedding, no wardrobe, no clothes. Literally nothing inside at all. Just an empty, sopping wet shell of a shack. None of the people there had any water supply, nor did they have any toilet facilities. I did hear that the community had built a communal toilet, but it had been pulled down by the authorities as it wasn't approved. I didn't dare ask what they used instead, because it was pretty obvious that we were walking through it. I must admit that I was having a great deal of trouble with my emotions. I just couldn't help thinking about how we live here in God's own. And I guess my guilt meter was working really overtime. Not far from her home was a school where the children were at least having some teaching. But again, there was no facilities. Certainly no tables and chairs, no black or white boards, and obviously no computers. But children, being children, are the same the world over, and they were fascinated with blowing bubbles and seeing their photos on iPhones. Nye took us back her way to the bus, and we soon understood why, because it was on slightly higher ground, so we didn't have to wade through the water and sewage. The building project we're involved in is a partnership between Habitat for Humanity Cambodia and PSE, the French-funded Christian charity school we just heard about on the YouTube. PSE was begun back in 1995 when a group of French tourists visiting Phnom Penh saw the masses of children living on the tip site. They went home, raised funds, and formed the organisation that now has over 2,000 children attending the school. They take the children that are living in these terrible living conditions, give them an education right through and including trade training, rehouse the families, and find employment for the parents, and then provide full medical and health care. What a great mission that is. What do us Kiwis do in circumstances like this? We tend to think that if we throw money at the problem, it'll go away. But all we do is create a people that are dependent on handouts. We were to work on the first block of the development that will eventually house 300 families. The area is called Smile Village. It's a completely new greenfields development that's being funded by PSE. And it's in an area where all the clothing factories are, so there will be plenty of employment for the parents. The plan was for a contractor to build the main concrete structure in the first and second floors, and then we, the volunteers, would do the concrete blocks for the walls. This proved to be a huge challenge, as the contractor was barely out of the ground when I arrived 3 weeks before the volunteers. But by encouragement, bribery and threats, we did manage to get enough concrete poured to completed to be able to find sufficient work for the volunteers for the week of the build. Even if we didn't get as far as was first planned, there was a huge amount of progress made, so people like Nye could see their new homes taking shape. Pride of Place in her new home will be the framed photo she was presented with. It shows her and all the Kiwis that worked on her home. And she stood there for ages with a smile and just touched each person in the photo one by one. A very moving moment. Nye was over the moon. She came to the site every day. I believe it cost her $5 every time she came out, which sounds nothing to us. But when you're selling plastic bottles, that's a huge amount of income. But she came there every day and made sure that all the volunteers had plenty of water. And boy, was that necessary. The humidity was so unbelievable that I was going through something like 10 bottles a day. she would also run to get buckets of mortar, concrete blocks, or anything else that she could see that we needed. And you've never seen such a happy person. Whenever she caught your eye, she would just burst into such a huge big smile that one day I said to her, "Nye, if you don't stop smiling so much, all your teeth are going to fall out." That just brought more smiles and laughter. She sat next to me one day at lunch, grabbed my hand and was chattering away until I called over an interpreter and said, asked what she was saying. She said, "My father died when I was a little girl, many years ago. You are now my father. And now I'm going to be all right because you've taken care of me." Well, how to get an old fella crying, and it still does. This was just one of the many times that I had found my tear ducts getting a real workout. I understand that if our family was slaughtered under the Pol Pot regime, as was the case with many of the people that I had contact with. The final day, Nye was very embarrassed because she said, "I have nothing to give you to repay you for what you've done for me." But she'd made necklaces for members of the team. But again, she was embarrassed because she'd run out of beads, so many of the people had to just put up with little bangles. I chose the Bible reading this morning from Matthew especially because it was a passage that kept coming to me right through my time in Cambodia. There were certainly times of frustration. Frustration when the weather was not cooperating and we had flooding to contend with. When the contractor was not keeping up with the schedule we'd all agreed to. When materials couldn't be delivered because the government wouldn't allow delivery of bulk materials due to the political protests that were happening. And then frustration when deliveries were allowed and the trucks got bogged down before they got to the site. And finally, the worst of them all, the frustration and disappointed when on the Wednesday night of the build week, it poured all night and flooded the site so much that work had to be called off for the next day. But through all these times, the words of Matthew would come to me. "When you did it for one of the least of these, my brothers and sisters, you are doing it for me." What a great encouragement that is, that no matter how hard things seem to be, no matter how many things go wrong, and no matter what or how hard the problems are, these are God's children. He loves them just as much as he loves you and me. No matter how unlovely they may seem, no matter how dirty or smelly they may be, they are children of God, just like you and I. In fact, I had a feeling one day that perhaps God loves them even more than me. Why? Because they haven't had the opportunities that I've had. They haven't had the privilege of growing up in God's own. And yet they didn't moan, they didn't complain about their lot, and they didn't hanker for the things that we find so important. They may not know God personally as I know him, but have they had the opportunity to know him? Have they even heard the good news of Jesus? All these thoughts just cemented the desire in me to keep going, to keep doing what I can to make some of these people's lives more meaningful. Why? Because I don't want, on that final day when I'm standing at the pearly gates trying to talk my way in, to have verses 41 to 45 quoted to me. "When did we ever see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or in prison and not help you?" And he will answer, "I tell you the truth, when you refuse to help the least of these, my brothers and sisters, you are refusing to help me." I can honestly say that I've never ever felt so fulfilled, so rewarded, and so completely satisfied as when I see the look on the faces of the people that are being lifted out of such terrible living conditions. Their look on their face is one of complete joy, of the knowledge that their lives will never be the same again, because this is the beginning of a whole new life. Life for them will never be the same again. This has been the hand up that they needed. You might be thinking, why couldn't they do something about their circumstances themselves? And that's a good question. But I'm reminded of a saying of an old friend of mine who used to say that when you're up to your eyeballs in crocodiles, it's hard to remember the object was to drain the swamp. I think that's exactly what these people are like. When you have to live with the stench of raw sewage, of rain coming through your roof, and all you have is a few cents that you've saved by selling old plastic bottles for recycling, how can you see a way out? How can you ever escape the crocodiles? In closing, I'd like to challenge you all this morning to think seriously about the verses we've just read. And if you feel you could respond to the plight of God's people, why don't you join Wendy and I and about 10 others from the Howick area and come to Nepal later this year in November, for the Everest build. The goal is to build 100 houses in 1 week with 1,000 international volunteers. You might think, I can't spare the time, I'm too old, or I can't afford it, or one of the many other good reasons why that's not possible. But maybe what you could do is to help somebody else to come. You could perhaps help sponsor somebody. And if you are thinking that finance is something that would hold you back, don't let that hold you back from inquiring, because there have been many occasions in the past when we've seen how God has been able to move mountains and pull out something quite magic out of the bag. I should warn you, though, that there's a serious risk of catching a disease that's known as hepatitis. It spreads very easily, and it's very hard to cure. But what I can promise you is an experience like no other. You will never look at the materialistic way we live in the same way again, and you will certainly be conscious that God is smiling on you. Amen.
How can we not be